Welcome to ITE 1, Module 11, Part 3, which is going to be the last bit of upgrading your computers and advanced technician. Before I start, does anyone have any questions? Cool, we will...
You didn't give them very long.
Well, do you?
Yeah, you've got to actually give the audio time to actually get to the other side of the planet. But I think we're right.
Yeah, I think we're good.
Yeah, I can't think. I don't have any, but...
Okay, good, good. All right. We are going to talk about upgrading storage media. And instead of actually going and buying a whole new computer because you want more storage, did you guys know that you can just upgrade your hard drive to get faster access and more storage? Besides these reasons, why else do you guys think you might actually want to upgrade a new hard drive or get a new hard drive?
If your hard drive goes bang and smokes.
Fantastic.
Or if your hard drive is just slow.
Yeah. What if you wanted to install a second operating system? Or possibly have one... It says here that you could have a hard drive to hold the system swap file. Why you would put a new hard drive in? It just to do that is beyond me.
I know why.
Why?
Because if you have a certain specific performance requirement, and say, for example, you buy yourself a small SSD of 16 or 32 gig, it's far more efficient to store the swap file on there where it will not suffer from the seek performance of having the swap file saved on the same drive as your operating system. It'll actually cut down the head movement and increase system performance. So back in the old days when we all didn't have 4 gig of RAM in our machines, it was a common practice to put your swap file out on your secondary hard drive so that while the operating system was swapping to the second hard drive, the original hard drive could go on reading and writing its stuff without the head disruption.
Yeah, fair enough. I didn't say you shouldn't do that if you've got a secondary hard drive, but I didn't think you'd just buy one just to do that.
Well, in things like Photoshop and stuff where you're using incredible amounts of memory, swap is paramount, especially if you're doing 3D rendering and stuff, so there are situations where that would be useful.
Okay. You can also get a hard drive to provide backups. Yeah, that's pretty obvious. To increase fault tolerance using something like RAID. Things to consider when adding a new hard drive is that if you have a PATA drive, you're going to need to make sure that it's cabled correctly and that it's jumpered correctly. One drive is going to have to be the master, and one drive is going to have to be the slave. Now, most drives are cable select, but that's something you're actually going to want to check with your hard drive's manual to make sure that it is. Otherwise, you get a sighted person, you get the hard drive manual, and you have them help you set up your jumpers. Usually, on a cable select drive, the end hard drive is going to be the master, and the middle one is going to be the slave. SATA drives do... Go ahead.
Do all PATA, like, chipsets support cable select?
No.
Yeah, they do. No, okay. They do, actually. Yeah. But not all drives agree on how the cable select is going to be implemented, and given timing funnies between Seagate and Western Digital and a whole lot of other things I don't want to go into, sometimes the cable select isn't as reliable as what you'd like it to be. So, generally speaking, it pays to hard set them to master and slave as you want them.
Or you have another and much better option, which is use SATA, which has its own cable. So each SATA drive is on one cable, and they don't have this problem because they each have a cable. So use them. They're just way easier to work with, and you don't have that problem, and so much easier to install.
They're much thinner, too, which helps airflow in your case.
Yeah, exactly. Chris was saying last night when he was building our machines, he's like the first day he was doing the computer shop and his first day of work experience, he was installing IDE drives and they've gone about all this master and slave stuff and he's just like, what?
This is pretty common sense for you guys, but as technicians, when we're going to add new partitions and drive letters, some planning goes a long way. Actually, plan these and organize these so they make sense. You don't need partition A, D, F, H, and K. Maybe putting them closer together and making them more logical is a good idea.
Just another point and that people may not be aware of. Did you also know that you can mount the contents of a drive under a folder so it doesn't actually require a drive letter? That's good when you...
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's, you can do that for when you
they
run out of drive letters.
They talk about that in chapter 12.
Oh, okay.
Cool. That's just really interesting.
That actually made it make sense now, because when I read it, it didn't make sense. So now I get it.
Good, because you're presenting it next. What were you going to say, Aiden?
I know. Just try to make sure that the main drive is the C drive on the computer, so the next technician coming over doesn't have heart problems. I took a look at a computer, and when I plugged in my 128 meg MP3 player, it became the C drive. The drive in the thing was D, which of course made installing programs very interesting, because I didn't think, and of course it installs a C program file, Jim Kitchen Zinc. A whole bunch of directories, which I then had to move to D and reinstall.
And that's actually a badly written installer, because what's actually supposed to happen is the installer is supposed to actually see what the Windows drive actually is, rather than just blindly assuming that it's C. But of course, most of them don't. They just go, no, C is what you want. And
well,
I have actually
it
seen.
It was WinZip, basically.
Yeah. Sometimes they're hard coded to CC. But what actually happens is there are actually some systems. It's usually an auto detect funny with Windows that causes that to happen, and then once it's happened, people don't get around to changing it. And believe me, you can't change it easily. It's basically a reinstall Windows over the top of itself job with the correct drive letters, and then tidy up the mess.
Yuck. What did you mean by mounting the contents of the drive in a folder?
Well, when you go into Disk Management, and you go right-click Manage and go down to Disk Management, there are options for each of the partitions that show up on your computer. So you find the healthy NTFS partition 500 gig, and you right-click on it, and you go Assign Drive Letter or Paths, and instead of assign the following drive letter Q, you can actually assign the path / huge music collection. And it will actually put the entire contents of the drive under the path C:\ huge music collection, rather than assigning a drive letter.
That's pretty cool.
Doesn't that defeat the purpose of having a partition on a hard drive, though?
It just makes it so that you it's like having a shortcut to it. It's the same. It just gives you an easier way to go to it without wasting a drive letter. I had a computer where the CD drive by default out of the box was drive Q, which that's when you said that sort of made me laugh.
I actually do that with CD-ROM drives, because I actually move mine down towards the end of the alphabet, sort of around the R or T or whatever, so that they don't shift around when devices are added or removed. The devices you add and remove can, you know, be E, F, G, but then the CDs can stay where it is, because a lot of programs hard code themselves off coming off a CD. Office used to do that until you found the bizarre Fix This Mess tool from Microsoft that would allow you to change the install location.
I think it Fair still enough. Does up to at least 03 anyway.
Well, most CD drives are D, aren't they?
Don't have to be.
If you've got two hard disk partitions, if you've got two hard disk partitions that are primaries, they'll often get allocated C and D before the CD-ROM gets a look in, and it'll be E.
Or you can be like me and have a D that's a CD-ROM drive that's horrible, and an E that's an actual DVD burning thing.
Yeah, dual drives. Okay, sorry about that. That was confusing. I thought somebody from class actually wanted to Skype message me, and I have no idea who it was, so... And whoever it was, sorry! okay, RAID, obviously, requires two or more disks. You can install RAID using hardware or software configuration. Hardware is more dependable but more expensive. Software installations are created and managed by an operating system such as a Windows Server 2008. You need to evaluate the cost, performance, and reliability of the RAID array systems to decide which one is going to meet your needs. There are many different RAID array configurations. There's a really nice table on this in Module 1 if you care to look at it and learn about the RAID configurations, but I do not believe you are tested on them after Chapter 1. There were no RAID questions in the final, were there, Drew? Ah, he must not be awake. Alright, anyway. We talk about installing a hard drive, which we did in Module 3. We put the drive into the bay, attach the cables, screw it in, test the drive. If the drive doesn't work, you might want to actually go into the BIOS, see if it detects it, and check on the boot order. You need to partition your drive, which can be done by using Windows Disk Management.
Now this is just a quick aside. Anybody who doesn't like Windows Disk Management because they happen to be using NVDA and they haven't got used to the weird review keystrokes and stuff for it, which there's actually a tutorial on now, I think. But anyway, you can actually do this from the command line. I can see Grace shuddering from here, with a thing called diskpart. And sometimes if you want to blow all the partitioning information away on an external drive because it's become unbelievably corrupt and strange, you actually want to go select disk 1 and then clean, and that will clean off all the partitioning information from whatever operating system you've got. So disk part is kind of cool.
Another thing you might want to install, and I do, but I had a problem with this that I'm going to tell you guys about now because it's completely and totally relevant, is a media reader. You can install a USB media reader that's going to be external. You can also install a FireWire one, or you can install an internal one. This needs a 3.5 or 5.25 inch bracket to be open. Now, here's something that you guys should probably know. Most computers no longer have 3.5 inch external bays. So when you get a new computer, your 3.5-inch floppy drive and media reader may not actually go into your case. So that is just something that you all need to be aware of. If you really want one, you'll have to find a case.
Did your case that you just got not have any?
Yep.
I wouldn't say most computers. I'd say a percentage of them don't have them. One of the problems with the cases we've got is all of the 6 3.5-inch bays are internal. So there's no external access to them. And we went to mount the reader in a 5 1/4-inch bay because it was a 3.5-inch reader. But because they were mounting rails and not one of the actual entire 3.5-inch sort of moldy brackets, there was actually going to be holes on either side of the reader. So we decided not to do that. We didn't bother putting the reader on.
Yeah, we'll have to buy new ones. They're not expensive, but that's just a FYI. To be fair, I wasn't actually planning on installing the card reader. I didn't even know we had it, so I didn't do my research and check if I could do it.
The computer that I almost got, or I will get when it's sitting in my friend's house, actually is one of the few cases I've seen in a while that has a floppy drive in it.
Oh, fair enough. So actually, guys, there's a diagram here in Module 11 that has the advantages and disadvantages of all sorts of different RAID configurations. So if you're curious, it's all here, and you can read all about it.
The other small point I was going to make is that...
That makes my head spin.
Fair enough.
One of the things I was going to mention was there is actually a lot of system boards that come with RAID on board. Say, for example, our boards have got RAID on board. This is actually what we call fake RAID. It's sort of a hybrid between software and hardware. Basically, there is enough RAID support in the BIOS to actually boot yourself off a RAID volume. However, if you don't have the BIOS drivers, you don't get access to your RAID devices, which, if you're lucky enough to be using Windows 7, becomes easier. But if you're not, you need to feed the RAID drivers in at install time with F6 or whatever. Luckily, Windows 7 can pull stuff off thumb drives and stuff, which Windows XP couldn't. You had to make floppies or slipstream the drivers into the CDs. But we don't talk about that here as such. But it can be a challenge. And don't even get me started on how much trouble we had updating the BIOS last night.
That was an hour and a half job, and it should have been like 10 minutes.
We discovered that you can't put a 2 megabyte BIOS file on a 1.44 meg floppy, which we wish that Asus had discovered as well, because they said put it on a floppy, and that wasn't going to happen.
Hello?
They just make guys. The computers. They don't need to know how to use them.
Absolutely. And
have they ever tried to update that BIOS of one of their own machines at any point, ever?
Apparently not.
Yeah, probably from inside Windows.
Well, you guys know how much I love the Asus site already. Well, Grace does.
Oh, jeez, their hardware is second to none. Really good hardware.
And their software is none to second.
Well, trying to find replacement parts is none to 83rd.
No.
The trick with Asus, if anybody wants to know, and I think everybody on here knows, but I'll just point it out anyway, you go to support.asus.com/downloads. And once you get in there, and make sure you're running WebVism or Celona is online, because if you want to download anything, unless you use the FTP site, there's a capture to solve. Although if you do want to use the FTP site, it's actually quite nice if you can find what you're looking for.
Yeah, you're going to be doing some waiting if you're using the FTP site, but it's not a bad site at all.
So what did you do, just put it on a flash?
Oh, no.
We had to install Windows first, and then we could upgrade the BIOS.
Because we went to put it on the flash drive, you go into Easy Flash, and then you try to press the button to go into Easy Flash, and it wouldn't. So it was like, oh, great. So then we tried a floppy drive, and it's like, no. And then we tried DOS USB drivers on a floppy, and then it was like, no. And then we just installed Windows and upgraded it inside of Windows because it was just
that
easier.
That's crazy. Yeah, I've been able to flash BIOS off of Flash disk before with no issues, so that's really stupid of them.
Also, have we. It was just special. Drew, I'd asked you a question earlier when you were away. Are there any questions on RAID versions in the final? I didn't think there were.
There was one question that talks about RAID, but I believe that was it. It didn't ask about different versions of RAID, but it did ask, like, what would you use for a backup, something like that.
Oh, that's fine. I was just curious what if they asked for versions, because I was going to tell them to study this table.
Yeah, there was some question they had where RAID was one of the answers, but I believe that's all they did.
That's fine. Okay, next we're going to talk about input and output devices. Eventually, your keyboard, mouse, speakers, or monitor will die. Then it's time to upgrade it. Also, sound cards are included in this category. You might want to upgrade to a more ergonomic keyboard. You may want different features. You might want one of those swank new media keyboards. Huh. Remember, guys, they have mute buttons, so make sure you know where those are. They might also be used to accommodate people with disabilities. You might need a special microphone headset for dragging dictation or something like that. Sometimes
you might need a back keyboard.
Yeah.
Or a netball, because we've got some of those.
Braille display.
That thing's weird.
Hey, speaking of Braille displays, Braille display. Quick little question for you all. Is that an input or an output device normally?
Normally,
it would be output.
Doing both.
That's right.
Yeah.
The new ones are both.
Yes, the new ones can be both.
With the keyboards. Although I suppose with the cursor writing buttons, you could sort of count the cursor writing
that's
as
input. That's what I want for that. That's what I want Santa to bring me, a nice new shiny Braille Connect. Anyway.
Dream about it.
40 may be nice.
Oh, they are expensive. Sometimes it's not possible, or you don't even want to prefer to put new input devices into expansion slots or sockets. In this case, you might want to use a USB connection. Actually, you probably do, depending on the output device.
Some keyboards now also have USB hubs built in.
Yeah.
Very low power ones that you have to be very careful with.
If you don't have extra USB slots, you can install an adapter card, or you can get a hub. After getting the new equipment, you will probably have to install drivers if it's not plug and play.
Now, just a point here. Read the instructions. Do not plug the new equipment into your machine and then mess around with it and then throw it against the wall when you can't get it to work. When the instructions clearly said in big yellow letters, install the CD first. And yes, there is hardware where it blows up very badly if you don't install the drivers first. Because Windows has some default drivers that it puts in that can cause the hardware completely to fail to work, and then you have to go running around trying to knock these drivers out of the system before you can feed the other drivers in.
With some with some specialty hardware, it doesn't even know that what you're trying to install is a sound card or something, so it'll, like, install a completely wrong device for it, and just it confuses it horribly. Like, the wrong default driver, like, it's not even an audio driver, tries to put in, like, it's like, it ruins it.
Okay, so I have a question.
If you know you're going to buy something new, having a sighted person around to read those big yellow letters is very handy. In fact, Like, I'll have one of my friends go with me, and we'll buy something, and I'll say, okay, can you please come back and, like, help me set this thing up? And usually, because he's strange, he'll end up reading the Spanish and French directions as after I'm trying to figure it out, and he's already read the English once, and he tries to butcher the other languages.
Oh,
most
goodness.
Everyone has documentation either on the CD or on the website, though.
Absolutely. It's readable.
You
guys can
at least look for before you just go running stuff.
If you happen to go to the mall independently and buy your new Soundguard, you can find the instructions on the website or CD if you don't have a sighted person around. Now I've got a question for you guys.
Well, if there's a store date at the store,
this is true. All right. So you just went and bought this new, swank, awesome gaming headset from your friend Sammy. It's just a great headset. You get it home, you open the box, and you realize, as you should have before, that Sammy is really unorganized, and there's no drivers in the box. Rather than going over and, you know, yelling at Sammy, what should you do in this case?
Ask your friendly sighted person to see if the model number is on the headset or in the box, and look it up online.
Absolutely. Or if you know the model number because you bought it and you probably researched it online, you can go to the manufacturer's website yourself and download those drivers, and the crisis is averted.
This is an interesting point, actually, and funny you should mention headsets. If you get the normal C-Media CMI headsets that most people get, and the Logitechs have got a CMI chip in them, and most of them have got a CMI 106 or a 108. When you install the headset and you plug it into Windows, Windows goes, oh, USB audio device, blablunk, blablunk, and off it goes. What you probably don't realize, and this probably is no longer true under 7, but it's certainly true under XP, unless you install the manufacturer's drivers, you don't get a mic boost. So, yes, the headset will work, it's just the microphone will be very quiet, and sometimes the volume buttons and stuff don't play ball. So do be aware that even if Windows comes up with a default driver, sometimes you need the souped-up one from the manufacturer off the website.
So we must mention, because it's in the test, signed drivers. A signed driver is a driver that has passed Windows hardware quality lab test and has been given a driver signature by Microsoft. Installing an unsigned driver can cause system instability, error messages, and boot problems. During hardware installation, if an unsigned driver is detected, you'll be asked to stop or continue installation of this driver. And seriously, some Microsoft drivers aren't even signed, so yeah. If you know what you're installing and you've seen it work before, then don't worry about it so much and go ahead and install it. All right, the last two sections are your preventative maintenance and troubleshooting, which, as I said, are yours to go over because you guys are grown-ups and can do that. So, just hold on 1 second while I load the test. Are there any questions on this chapter? Not yet, but it will be.
Very long ago.
Quiz.
Oh, the other handy hint I was going to tell you, Sean, which just occurred to me, is if you mess around with the web server on your Mac, and there is one, you can share out a folder on your local network so that you can just copy files into that folder and then drag them down with the BrowSense, which is what we're going to be doing after lecture. So you don't have to worry about sticking cards into things and all that sort of stuff.
Can you do it with Windows too?
Yeah.
You probably could. We're probably going to just use the Linux server.
Use personal web server, for example, or
A home file server, HFS, will do it just fine. And that is, like, on training wheels amazingness. I mean, I can run it, and I know nothing about HTML or websites.
I hate the directories. The indexes that thing generates, they're appalling, but yeah, it does work.
That'll be interesting.
I used it.
Does the BrailleSense have network? I don't think the BrailleSense can do LAN stuff, though.
Yes, it can.
Well, it can't do LAN. You can't connect it up to the LAN and do like Samba or anything. But
Carrie, you'll have to explain what your scenario was. Another time, because I didn't quite get it, and you buffered for like 30 seconds at one point. So I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, you started it, and then there was a huge delay, and then you came back.
Okay.
So explain that to me another time.
It's a really good idea if you've got a note taker with web access. All right. Here we go, everybody in your chat windows, please. Oh, if I could use the right keyboard, that would be fantastic. I'm reaching up and trying to type on my laptop and move myself over into the chat window, and that doesn't work because I'm on my new desktop. Hey, Drew, you're not in the chat window.
Oh.
Come on, you can pause 5 seconds from those six audio projects that you're mixing in the background there and the Twitter that you're looking through.
I can.
Yes, you can.
Yes, you can. You can and you will.
I actually entered the chat room 6 seconds ago.
Okay, cool. All right. Number one, which two causes can affect the correct flow of air and lead to a computer overheating? Choose two. All right. Two case pans, one pulling and one pushing. So yes or no? Ah.
Yeah, you got to check the text-to-speech box or you won't hear them.
That does help. Anyone else? The answer is no, because that's usually how you want them. One is going to pull air in, one is going to push hot air out. How about a missing expansion slot cover?
I'd be saying no to that one.
I'd say yes.
Well, it wouldn't affect it negatively, would it?
I think it would affect it negatively, because you could get all sorts of dust and stuff in there.
Well, Cisco says yes.
Didn't the question ask specifically about overheating, though? Or what was the question?
No, it said affect airflow.
Affect airflow. Okay.
Oh, no, it says which. Can affect airflow and lead to computer overheating. I think if it got dust in it.
But you'd think but the dust would only get into the computer bits like the hard drive and stuff if the air was being sucked in through the empty slot. I mean, if the dust goes in the slot, wouldn't it just settle on the floor of the case
dust
and not
flies everywhere.
Cause a problem?
Dust goes everywhere.
Yeah. Settles any which way. I mean, I've run computers with giant open slots, and it hasn't been a problem. At the same time, I can see how it would be a problem.
It depends on the environment, I think.
It's a stupid question. Anyway,
It is a stupid question. All right. Yeah. Dust buildup around the fans and air vents? Hey, there's one we can all agree from. Yes, absolutely. Heatsink added to the north bridge? No, I think you guys are right. That'd be a no.
Gets defended on form factor.
Yeah. Missing slot coolers?
They exist.
That's what I said.
I don't think they do.
Yeah, they do.
I think that's the... Oh, really?
Yeah,
there are those. You can actually get cards that actually use the slot bracket as a fan grill, and they're actually little thin, low-profile fans that suck air from the front of the case and blow it out the back, and you put them, like, under your, you know, GeForce 9 billion video card that is, like, you know, hotter than a supernova, and that cools it down so that it can be stable enough for you to get to the boot screen.
Basically.
Yeah, but its fans started going about a month ago, and you forgot to do anything about it.
Card. Well, then you're into more trouble than we can help you with, I think.
I guess.
I'd say that's a no, but maybe that's no, because
we'll
honestly,
say no.
Honestly, I've never even seen one of these things in my life, so it must not affect airflow that much. All right. On to a question that makes more sense. Which activity increases the chance of computer components becoming damaged from ESD? Is it A, touching the metal case before working on a computer? B, walking across a carpet or rug and touching components? C, using anti-static mats when working with components? Or D, using non-magnetic tools when working on a computer? Answer now? B is right. That will probably make your computer... Yeah, components get quite a zap.
I actually have one question about cooling. Mm-hmm. This is probably a question that will only be of interest to me and maybe two other people 5 years later listening to this. A lot of, in like studios and stuff, they want to put like acoustical foam actually inside of the computer to try and make the sound of the computer as quiet as absolutely possible so that it doesn't pick up the mics. And I was wondering, if you've got that in there, how does that affect cooling? Do you need to put extra things in there? Because I think that would heat it up if you don't give
fire hazard
and the air somewhere to go.
Yeah. No, it depending on how the computer is designed, it's not generally too much of a problem. As long as you can actually get some air through the foam, so the foam's got to be fairly porous. I mean, the thing's not to try at home. I know somebody who had like a couple of worn-out tracksuits and stuff piled into his computer for acoustic dampening, which worked quite well. They were, you know, last winter's tracksuits from the supermarket that were no longer any good for wearing, so he used them for damping the sound of his computer.
If you're going to get something and actually re-put it in your computer like that, why wouldn't you just move the computer and use everything off of hubs and extension cords?
Longer cables, more electromagnetic interference, just a pain. There's already enough cables in the studio anyway.
Okay.
Okay, question 3. Which two devices should not be repaired while wearing an anti-static device? Choose. This is a yes or no. Hard drive. That's actually right. Hard drive you do want to. Memory? Anyone else?
I found that out the hard way.
No, you definitely want anti-static on that. How about a modem? Alright, that is right. Not a modem. Hey, monitor.
The one person that said yes is correct. We should qualify that. CRT monitor.
Yeah, basically. In fact, you shouldn't be repairing these components that we need to use an anti-static wrist strap at all, because you're not trained to do so, and as blind people, you probably won't be trained to do so, which is okay. How about a power supply? Anyone else? Yeah, a power supply is a yes. Do not use an anti-static wrist strap with a power supply, because you will get voltage. You don't want to be the ground in that connection. Okay. 4.
Oh, right. That's the same thing about the monitor. I've heard about that. My friend fixes a monitor or TV, he usually leaves it unplugged for a good day or so to let all the voltage discharge. So.
I've
actually been told that some of the capacitors can hold it for 3 months.
Wow.
The other thing to keep in mind is that luckily they don't do it on new stuff, but on the older CRTs and stuff, the outside of the chassis and stuff was actually live, and that's another reason why you wouldn't want to do work on them. And I spoke to an old television technician who assured me that he had been belted by this equipment quite a number of times, and he said it was actually quite a challenge to repair this stuff because you're dealing with very high voltages. It's not the safest thing in the world.
I hope they were compensated amply for that.
Oh no, this was like 1960, 1970. No, there was no OH&S back then. Not to the point there is today.
Couldn't pay me to do that work, man.
Oh, no. As I said, you guys will not be doing this sort of thing.
How are LCDs about this sort of thing? I imagine they're slightly more safe, but there's a whole different...
I wouldn't go in and take apart an LCD monitor.
Yeah, why not? I'm just curious what's involved.
They're safe. The LCD is a sealed unit, and we are dealing with fairly low voltages. However, I would recommend not taking them apart, because unless you're very good, you may not get it back together again. And let's face it, they're so cheap, you might just pick up another one.
Basically. Computer components should be disposed of properly to meet state and federal standards. Which three dangerous metals can be found in computer components? Choose 3. Cadmium?
Yep,
that's right. Good job. Carbon?
No.
First of all, carbon isn't a metal.
Well, first of all, carbon isn't really that dangerous.
Second, it's not dangerous.
That's right. How about hydrogen?
No.
Again, not a metal.
It's in some batteries, isn't it?
Hydrogen isn't a metal.
It's discharged. Well, right, hydrogen's... I know it's not a metal.
No. How about lead?
Yes.
I don't think so, actually.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is. Lead is in 4.5 pounds of lead in monitors. Remember that?
Oh.
In monitors. So, yeah. Really? Quite a bit of lead.
Huh.
How about mercury?
In LCD?
Not necessarily.
Yep.
We've got mercury, which is a yes. And nitrogen, another quite laughable answer because it's not a metal. I enjoyed this question because I did take 7th grade chemistry, and it made me laugh some.
Yeah, it was amusing.
Carbon is one of those interesting compounds that it isn't a metal, but it behaves very similarly to one. So you will have some people argue that because carbon can conduct electricity, it's got metallic properties.
I can conduct electricity, and I am not a metal man.
Conduction is all relative, though. We're talking about conduct it with very little resistance. We're not talking about a screaming fried Drew that goes...
I wouldn't sound like... That'd be much
better. Let's not find out.
You might.
Are you one of those that likes electricity?
Let's play fried Drew!
Alright. Alright, a technician has been called to troubleshoot a computer.
Go over to England.
The user reports that the computer has become louder during use, and I think we actually have a sound. Do you have the sound bite for this question, or is it not on that computer?
I can get to it, hang on.
We have a sound
clue for you. We play
it
on speakers, but I can get to
it. Oh, that's fine. you guys get to diagnose this problem. By having a listen to it.
I love how my computer is so quiet that if, like, the processor speeds up, then I can hear that it's working harder. I can hear my heat sinking going, so I can tell when something's wrong. It's so quiet my case fans are.
I can hear our hard drives are so much louder than the rest of our new systems. It's unbelievable.
Here we go. Right. What does this mean? There's your sound clue.
Oh, and the programs are slow to load.
That's
which component failed? CPU?
It sounds
hard
like
drive,
someone's shaking.
Memory or floppy drive? What do you think has epically failed?
B.
B is right, absolutely.
Floppy drives are a lot faster and a lot softer. I've gone through a few of those disks failing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they sort of go...
Yeah, I've heard some terrible
when
there's
holes get put in the disk.
Does anybody remember when you were like going home at, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you just finished all your work today and you hit Control S and your floppy drive went and you knew that you were not going home anytime soon.
Do you remember the Apple II? Well, I remember the Apple II, and if you bent the floppy it would go, and the 5 1/4 floppy would go really loud. It was fantastic.
Yeah,
it's really horrible sound if you actually
record. Yeah, horrifying.
Yes, that was impressive. There
sure
was actually somebody
out there somewhere.
There was actually no. There was one where it actually made this horrible grinding noise when the heads hit the end. And there was actually somebody who took the Amiga drives and made them play The Sound of Silence with the drive heads. I don't know how many times they did that, but I don't think their drive was any good afterwards.
Oh, my. Maybe they just didn't
I
care.
Wonder if that was on YouTube.
Maybe. It'd be interesting if it was. I know I've heard people... there was a program for the Amiga that would do it. A bit like the ScanJet Elise that we were handing around.
Would they at least warn you ahead of time this will likely destroy your hard drive?
Yes.
Or floppy drive.
Oh, fantastic.
Fair enough.
All right.
There is a whole site of dying hard drive sounds, and we could put the link out again, because I've got several more that were just really great that I had to record for myself. So I will put that link on the list.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. Question 6. While performing regular maintenance on a computer, a technician notices that the NIC is loose in the expansion slot. What is the proper course of action? And these are the kind of questions you're going to get on your final. Okay, replace the computer. Replace the NIC with the new card. Use thermal paste to secure the card into an expansion slot. Secure the adapter card in the expansion slot and tighten the retaining screw. Or the slot is most likely damaged. Use a new slot if there's one available. Choose now.
C
is right, because this we're going to try the quickest thing first, and some of those are just absolutely ridiculous.
Thermal
sometimes
paste
it is
for a video card.
No. Well, it's just meant to be. It's meant to be one of those answers that's meant to trick you. But some of the slots can be loose, so you can actually have to try a different slot depending on how the card's molded and that sort of thing. However, generally it's a case of tightening up the screw. Or replacing the screw with a different one. Although in my experience, usually somebody has screwed one of the really big thick screws into the hole and it's bent it all out and it's all just like completely munged, and yeah, a new slot's a good idea. And in fact, a new case might be a good idea when you save up for one as well.
When in doubt, screw first and ask questions later.
Something like that.
Okay. Question 7. What determines the maximum amount of RAM that can be installed on a particular motherboard? Is it A, size of the data bus, B, type of chipset, C, BIOS manufacturer, D, type of expansion slots available? Choose now. B. Anyone else want to go?
Marshall, you're not able to type him in?
That's okay.
No.
He's fine. That's okay. He might not always be right, which is fine.
No, I was just curious because I'm like, however, he doesn't normally.
That's okay. This time, however, Marshall is totally right. It is B. It is the type of chipset.
I don't like that question because there are times when the BIOS manufacturer can limit the amount of memory that's installed in the system, and that is a... But it's not as correct as the type of chipset, so we have to go for the most correct answer.
Yeah, I've seen that. That can be changed, though, right? Usually you can just sort of tell the BIOS I want to have...
Yeah, you can usually get a BIOS upgrade, and that'll fix you up.
Depends on the chipset. Some chipsets have actually only got the certain number of wires and stuff wired up on the bus, and they will not see more than a certain amount of memory, which can be a bit of a pain.
Okay, number 8. Which two I/O adapters would commonly be installed in a computer today? Choose two. DSP?
No.
Anyone else?
You can see that in the computer any day.
Yeah, I don't know what that actually is supposed to even be, but hey, that's a no. FireWire.
Yeah.
Commonly though.
Yeah, I've got a FireWire board on my desktop.
Like $70.
More commonly than, say...
I'm on the board $70 and I got it.
DSP, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, exactly. How about GPU?
No.
Nope, because GPU stands for Graphics Processing Unit, which we all know is not an input-output port. SCSI. B-A, no. USB? Absolutely. USB, of course, we're going to have USB. We're probably going to have lots of USB, which is a good thing. 9. Which type of technology does a solid-state drive use? A. Serial-attached RAM. B. Spatial relational memory. C. Static RAM. Or D. Synchronous dynamic RAM.
C.
That would be a C, because if it used dynamic RAM, well, we wouldn't have our data for very long. Which type of drive uses a 7-pin connector and is hot swappable?
Sometimes.
No, it is hot.
Yeah.
No, if you don't have the correct drivers in, your machine will come down, crash, blue screen, and die horribly. Sometimes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, believe me.
Alright, is it A, eSATA, B, Express Card, C, PATA, or D, SCSI?
A.
A, yep, that's right, it's A.
Just a warning for you guys, all of those people who couldn't get the drivers to slipstream in at install time and decided they couldn't be bothered and ended up switching their machine back to IDE mode, you now have just lost the ability to hot swap any SATA devices. Sorry! You'll have to now go on one of those really nasty Windows forums that involves editing the registry, praying, copying files into various locations, and booting your computer in and out of safe mode to jam the IDE, the SATA drivers back in after install. It's not a lot of fun.
Or upgrade.
And then you'll have to do a ritual to some strange computer deity and sacrifice a goat.
I've never wanted to hot swap SATA drivers anyway, or drives.
Yeah.
It's actually quite useful.
Odds are good if I'm reaching in there, I'm going to be like reaching into the computer while it's on.
This is eSATA though.
This is outside the computer. And if you don't put the AHCI drivers in from the manufacturer, you actually lose out on all the native command queuing. So no longer can your hard drive go and execute 31 commands in the background while your computer gets on with its life. No, you're going to wait for the drive now. So it is actually quite a performance hit.
I'm pretty sure I have mine in there.
You can have a look in Device Mangler. It'll tell you.
How would it... I will, actually.
Okay, after troubleshooting a faulty computer, a technician determines that the issues relate to power. What are three common causes of power problems? Choose three. A failing CPU fan? No, that's not a power problem. That's going to bring your computer down to a screaming halt, but it is not a power problem.
It's a problem that could be caused by power problems.
Right. Yeah, but it isn't one. How about inadequate wattage?
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's pretty serious power problem. How about a faulty power supply?
Why?
way.
No.
Yep. That is true. CPU voltage set too high. Yeah, I am. That could be. I'm not really sure how much you can actually set. I mean, I know there are jumpers to set that, but
what about you should read our manual, our motherboard manual. Apparently, the CPU can go from 0.2 to 2.6 volts in 0.025 volt increments.
Shit. Anyway, that's a lot. But I think that the more likely answer is loose connections, because that is definitely going to be a power problem.
You would be surprised how many hard drives are killed by bad or unstable power with either bad Molexes, dicey SATA connections, or strange power supplies that we picked up for $20 at the swap meet. They can do big damage to hard drives.
Okay. On a Windows computer, the system information shows the wrong CPU speed in the system properties. The motherboard does not have any jumpers related to CPU speed, and the BIOS is showing the wrong setting. What could a technician do to solve this problem? Update the BIOS, configure the correct CPU model through the Device Manager, upgrade the Windows operating system to the latest version, or upgrade the motherboard to the bus speed that is suited to the processor. I'd go with A, actually. Upgrading the BIOS may fix this. That's the quick fix. Before we go out and buy a new motherboard, let's go see if there's a BIOS update available.
There are cases where many BIOSes will misdetect the CPU speed and not run certain processes, and they will run newer processes sometimes at a lower speed than what they should, so it probably pays to check that there isn't a new BIOS to go in and fix it up, if you know the processor is actually faster.
Of course, if you do that, and you're a JAWS user...
Yeah, you'll be getting another activation.
And then Freedom Scientific will look at you suspiciously and like, why do you keep updating your computer? What is this technology that I make a product in?
Basically.
That is actually true for any activated product, actually. There are lots of products like AutoCAD and stuff. It's not just Freedom Science Fiction.
Okay,
they're
a computer
just
has...
every blind person knows about and picks on.
Yeah, well.
I need to get more because my VM has eaten one of them, and I didn't change settings. Be aware of that, too, if you use virtual machines.
Be aware that I just got my activations reset, and I only got one, so...
Yeah, I've been getting only one for a while.
The other thing to be aware of, actually, guys, is where this actually would make a difference, you know, often... times is Windows activation is another one that will trip you up before JAWS even gets loaded. And if Microsoft decides not to reactivate you, you've then got to go and call product support and talk to them and stuff. And in some rare cases, when you really want it to work, it won't reactivate automatically, although most of the time it does.
Yeah, it's usually pretty nice about it. Like, I think there's like 5 different criteria they'll trip before they have to change before it'll say that it just won't do it again.
Yeah, it's quite reasonable. It's certainly a lot more reasonable than another manufacturer's scheme, shall we say.
Yeah. Okay, 13. A computer has integrated 10/100 NIC that no longer works. What possible solution can a technician try to solve this problem? Replace the CMOS battery? Update the motherboard BIOS, remove and reinstall the NIC drivers, disable the NIC through the BIOS, and use the FireWire port.
I like that, use the FireWire port.
Use the FireWire port. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like,
it's C.
For what, exactly?
You can actually do networking over the FireWire port. It actually does come up with a network interface. I'm not saying you should. Under a lot of Linux distributions, they actually turn off the FireWire networking by default because it confuses users, because it does come up as an Ethernet interface.
I've been told by various people to disable that networking thing on my Windows machine just because it when I'm using my FireWire card, just because it, like, confuses it or something.
The other thing I did the other day, which is just a tip, and don't do this if you actually require the functionality, is we went in and shut off IPv6 under the protocols because most home routers and stuff don't support IPv6, and there's no point having 200 quadruple A record lookups that fail before it actually does an A record lookup.
And it just, I mean, when you do IP config, it, especially in 7, it just cuts down the amount of clutter that's in the window.
Yeah, unless you have a use for IPv6, I would be tempted to go in and uncheck it, because I don't think it actually connects to the Teredo tunneling servers by default. I'll have to have a look. I'll be playing with it later today. But I don't think it actually does 6 and 4 tunneling by default, so you don't even get an IPv6 connection unless your underlying stuff supports it.
That's actually the reason why I uninstalled VMPlayer, because, I mean, obviously you need it if you're using it, but for most of the time it's just sitting there not doing anything, which is fine, except that it installs like half a dozen protocols to the system and a bunch of other stuff.
You can actually disable its network devices when it's not in use. That's the other way to do it. Just go disable the VNet interfaces until you need them.
It's got background processes and stuff too. I'm just like,
okay.
Isn't it supposed to be 80 days until IPv4 collapses?
For some of the lab chapters in... Oh, okay.
Sorry, Sean?
It's 90 days away.
I was going to say, for some of the labs in Chapter 12, Drew, you might want to get your virtual machine back up and running
again. He's graduated.
Oh, okay. Well, oops, sorry.
That's why I got VMPlayer.
But they are a good idea.
Last semester, I did... Yeah,
he's already done them last semester, so he didn't... He just wanted to go through some more exams and stuff.
And to answer your question, it's not actually IPv4 collapse, it's the inability to allocate any more IPv4 addresses, and yes, we are running out, and there is significant pressure on the industry to do something about it.
I didn't know it was that close.
Yeah. There's a tweet that Christopher Toth put up a couple of months ago that said the global registries would be out of IPv4 addresses to allocate in 90 days or something, and they will be. There will be no more to allocate. They'll have to start looking at reclaiming them from other places and stuff.
It doesn't matter. I mean, that doesn't mean it's done, because, I mean, that just means, basically means that Comcast can't keep taking gigantic blocks to, you know, because they all get shifted around anyway, so it's not as if that means that new people can't get IP addresses.
Well, no. Maybe what it means is that if you go out to get IP addresses, like as for like a website or whatever, and you want to get a new IPv4 address, you're not going to be able to do it unless you reallocate it from an existing block. But there are some organizations who have absolutely appalling use of IP addresses. For example, CSIRO has 6 Class Bs that are externally routable. They don't need that.
Yeah.
Maybe Comcast could just subscribe one IP to one user and actually keep it static, like other ISPs. That'd be nice.
Yeah, right.
There's one good reason why you wouldn't want that to happen, actually. If you're on a static IP, it's easier for the MPAA to come after you.
Not just the, like, this is my main complaint about IPv6, too. It doesn't have to do with the MPAA, just in general. I don't like random people on the internet being able to track my IP from forum to forum and know, oh, this is that guy, just based on the IP.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
That is a valid concern.
Okay.
I thought that maybe you should...
Are we done with the quiz?
No, we got one more. When a computer station starts, the floppy disk drive light is on, and it remains on. What could cause this problem? A, the wrong power connector attached. Yeah, it is. The wrong power connection is attached to the floppy drive. B, the data cable is not connected, but the power cable is connected. C, the floppy disk cable is connected to the hard drive connector. Or D, the floppy disk data cable is connected incorrectly.
D.
It's D. It's probably connected backwards. All right. That's the quiz. Now we will hand it over to Sean.